that a genocide is actually taking place. And so the calls for ceasefire are, it's still important, and so is this demand of recognition of genocide as well. And so again, two years later, we should listen to Palestinians, we should listen to writers, we should listen to artists, we should listen to scholars who've been dealing with these issues of othering and colonialism and genocide when they tell us what is actually taking place.
The comparison you see between, well, going back to Vietnam, and as we speak now, Israel dropping pamphlets and bombs on the largest city in Gaza, on Gaza City.
The parallels are very striking. The United States, when it went into Vietnam, on the one hand, it was fighting to support an ally, but it was also fighting an enemy at the same time. And basically what the United States did, as the journalist Nick Turse documented, was to kill everything that moves. Every dead Vietnamese was counted as a Viet Cong. And that is a genocidal policy that was certainly carried out throughout American history in fighting the Indian Wars. And it's the same policy that Israel is carrying out in Gaza as well. Indiscriminate killing of Palestinians. Any dead Palestinian is considered to be a potential enemy. This kind of mindset, where there is no distinction between enemy and civilian, is genocidal. It's certainly a policy of ethnic cleansing. It's hard to deny that what Israel is doing is very deliberately policy at this moment of trying to get rid of the Palestinians in Gaza. And so I see a distinct structural parallel and similarity between what Israel is doing in Gaza City at the moment and with Trump's rhetoric of deportation. If Trump had his way, he would literally try to deport every non-white person that he can, and he's getting off to a pretty strong start.
We have to leave it there. Viet Thanh Nguyen, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and scholar. We will see you in New York at Voices of Gaza. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman.
You are tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Cable Community Radio's annual meeting and board election will be held on Saturday, September 20th at 11:30 a.m. at Mississippi Studios in North Portland. At the annual meeting, members will have the opportunity to meet candidates running in the board election. Final votes will be cast and counted. The results of the elections will be announced at the end of the meeting. Online voting is open now through the annual meeting at cable.fm/board25. Paper ballots will be sent to members by mail. Again, that's KBOO's annual meeting and board election on Saturday, September 20th at 11:30 a.m. at Mississippi Studios, located at 3939 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbo.fm/board25.
KBOO's Loud and Proud. Become a member during our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 20th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots, independent, radically made community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. That's kboo.fm/give and help us reach our $45,000 goal. Thank you.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are stressed, worried, or just feeling down when they call or text 988. Support is confidential, and call takers are real people in Oregon who speak with understanding and respect. More info at 988oregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, the University of Oregon will lay off 60 staff in an effort to reduce budget deficit. Oregon DEQ fines a wood treatment company over $1 million for polluting the South Yamhill River. And new research shows negative impacts on kids' heart health if they spend all their time on screens. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 9, 2025. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Eric Leuschner. The University of Oregon will lay off 60 workers on top of 40 other job cuts made earlier this year. These layoffs do not include tenured or tenure-track faculty, and no degree programs will be eliminated. The university is also cutting 59 vacant positions for a total of 176 positions cut. That doesn't include student workers who won't be reappointed to their jobs this fall. These are part of a plan to cut $29 million from the budget to address a, quote, structural deficit. That comes from a drop in out-of-state tuition, which comes mainly from California students and international students. Lower enrollment, federal uncertainty, and high pension costs have challenged the university financially. Katie Mills is the leader of the faculty union, United Academics of UO. She told KLCC that the preservation of degree programs and tenured faculty jobs is a result from protests and advocacy by the workers. Other union leaders within the University of Oregon have called for administration to take on more of the cuts than the staff and faculty, since they're ultimately responsible for the budget. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality fines a wood treatment company in Sheridan over $1 million for repeat violations over the past 3 years. That's according to a new reporting from Investigate West. Canadian company Stella Jones was sending tainted stormwater into the South Yamhill River, where Sheridan residents get their drinking water. It was tainted with petrachlorophenol, a likely carcinogenic preservative. The EPA has imposed a ban on the substance starting in February of 2027. Oregon DEQ had been investigating this pollution for 4 years, but that fact was hidden from the public, all while Stella Jones continued to release more contaminated water. The Stella Jones plant was already designated as a Superfund site. In August, the company pled guilty to 10 misdemeanor charges of unlawful water pollution in the South Yamhill River. Locals asked DEQ directly about water quality during the investigation and the building of the criminal case, but only got vague responses. In the enforcement letter, the DEQ writes that the releases by Stella Jones, quote, had significant adverse impact on human health or the environment, end quote. But even so, the department has not moved to revoke the permit that allows Stella Jones to release water into the river. An agency spokesperson told Investigate West that to revoke the permit would be to lose a tool to regulate the facility. They also said the DEQ review took so long because of how complex the case was and how understaffed their enforcement office is. Health researchers are putting together evidence about the negative impacts of too much screen time. There are new findings about the risks for kids and how their heart health could deteriorate into adulthood if they don't mix in enough physical activity with their daily digital consumption as youths, Mike Moen reports.
Spending too much time on a smartphone or iPad is a bad habit that health researchers are paying more attention to. For youth, there's fresh evidence about poor heart health later in life, and Minnesota experts recognize the concerns. A new study in the Journal of the American Heart Association says increased time on digital devices or watching TV among children and young adults is linked to risk factors like high blood pressure and high cholesterol. The University of Minnesota's Jamie Lohr, a pediatric cardiologist, says the findings align with her research into childhood obesity. She says kids don't suddenly shake off these effects when they become adults, adding good habits take hold at younger ages.
These are the times that we form habits for daily exercise, for healthy eating. So there's no doubt from the research that these patterns of screen use in childhood impact you lifelong.
And it's not just lack of daily movement. Study authors also point out excessive screen time makes it harder for kids to get quality sleep, elevating the heart health risks. Laura and other experts say the findings reinforce the need for parents to ensure their kids weave in enough physical activity and put away their phones at least 1 hour before bed. They say parents need to set good examples by doing the same. These concerns can be traced back to the emergence of video games and cable TV. But Laura says this new study shines a light on just how much time kids are replacing other activities with social media scrolling or binge watching.
With self-reported screen time, an 18-year-old 6.1 hours, which is a quarter of their day spent on a screen that wasn't spent talking to their parents, talking to their siblings, doing household chores.
Janica Wirtz-O'Brien of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics echoes the call for families to work together on curbing screen time use with small goals to start with. She says that shared sense of responsible habits might actually resonate with teens.
Many of the adolescents I work with are smart and insightful. And when I ask them, what do you think is making you tired during the day? What do you think is getting in the way of your sleep? And they're like, well, if I just turn my phone off.
This is Mike Mullen for Minnesota News Connection.
The House Oversight Committee released a host of documents related to Jeffrey Epstein, including a lewd note Donald Trump allegedly wrote to the late convicted sex offender for his 50th birthday. The note was supposedly part of a 50th birthday album compiled in 2003. The item in Epstein's birthday book was made public from a subpoena the Republican-led committee sent to Epstein's estate last month. The album also allegedly contained names of some other prominent figures, such as former President Bill Clinton and attorney Alan Dershowitz, in a friends section. Other letters had sexually provocative language. Trump has said he did not write the letter or create the drawing of a nude woman that surrounds it. He filed a $10 billion lawsuit against the Wall Street Journal for earlier reporting concerning the letter. White House Press Secretary Karine Leavitt posted on social media, quote, "As I have said all along, it's very clear President Trump did not draw this picture and he did not sign it. President Trump's legal team will continue to aggressively pursue litigation," end quote. Trump has faced increasing pressure to force more disclosure in the case of Epstein and his former girlfriend, Ghislaine Maxwell. Epstein was accused of paying underage girls hundreds of dollars in cash for massages and then molesting them. Maxwell was convicted of sex trafficking, luring teenage girls to be sexually abused by Epstein. Trump has said the friendship ended 20 years ago and that he cut ties with Epstein because he, quote, "stole young women who worked at Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort." Trump suggested during his presidential campaign that he would seek to open the government's files into Epstein. The letter signed by Trump says, quote, "A pal is a wonderful thing. Happy birthday. And may every day be another wonderful secret," end quote. Experts warned that active clubs, white nationalist groups disguised as fitness and brotherhood organizations, are spreading rapidly in the U.S. and the world. Recruiting young white men through gyms and social media, they normalize racist ideologies under the guise of self-improvement. Their decentralized, leaderless structure makes them difficult to track, fueling multi-state and global coordination that poses growing risks of violence. Judith Ruiz Branch has more from Wisconsin.
Experts say they're seeing a rise in white nationalist movements in Wisconsin and across the country that are disguising themselves as fitness groups. They're called active clubs and present themselves as sporting clubs or fighting clubs focused on brotherhood. Art Gibson, professor of sociology and criminology at the University of Dayton, says they recruit both online and in person, targeting young white men using shared interests as tools to gradually introduce and normalize racist ideologies.
You add to that the willingness to engage in violence against people of color, LGBTQ people. There's a clear potential for violence here.
Gibson says active clubs often meet in Christian churches and gyms, with recent activity showing multi-state coordination, like a Wisconsin active club regularly meeting with an Illinois active club for family days. They use distinctive symbols like the Celtic cross, a well-known neo-Nazi symbol, and share content across social media platforms to maintain connections between chapters and other white supremacists. Supremacist groups. Active clubs are growing internationally as well, with the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism reporting a 25% increase since 2023. Gibson says the groups are a huge shift in organizing for white supremacists and white nationalists following what he calls a decentralized, leaderless resistance.
Their decentralized structure makes them difficult to track, but it also allows them to spread pretty quickly. They're embedding white supremacist and white nationalist ideology in everyday spaces rather than only the political rally.
Gibson says new chapters of active clubs are frequently being created and linking with one another. Members say they are dedicated to self-improvement and brotherhood, seeing themselves as a noble resistance in the cause of preserving the white race.
They are mobilizing around really powerful images and ideology that at the end of the day gives people something to believe in. And that's really difficult to combat.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch.
President Trump says new guidance on school prayer is coming soon. The U.S. Supreme Court allows more racial profiling in immigration enforcement, and Missouri unions mobilize against redistricting. With that story and more, it's Zamone Perez with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy and historic times.
To support students like Hannah, I'm pleased to announce this morning that the Department of Education will soon issue new guidance protecting the right to prayer in our public schools, and it's total protection.
President Donald Trump says new guidelines will prevent what he calls anti-Christian bias, like that against a Texas girl who he says was punished for organizing a prayer for an injured peer. The move matches a campaign promise, but is likely to face legal challenges. Courts have generally ruled that students are free to pray, while teachers and staff cannot mandate it. In Oklahoma, a Bible is now required in every classroom. In Louisiana, Arkansas, and Texas now require the Ten Commandments be displayed in them. Those laws have suffered court setbacks. The Supreme Court also just ruled 6-3 that ICE agents can use racial profiling to make LA immigration stops. That means officers can use a person's ethnicity, language, or job to demand proof of citizenship. Paul Perez of the National Border Patrol Council praised the ruling on Fox News.
This is great for our agents, but it's even better for the citizens of California and our country, because it's going to move the impediment of us allowing to go after these criminals that are all over the country.
Within hours of the ruling, Homeland Security announced major operations in Massachusetts and Chicago. Ernest Herrera with the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund says despite the court decision written by Justice Brett Kavanaugh, the decision violates the Constitution.
Justice Kavanaugh sacrifices the rights of all Latinos to the false Trumpist idol of unconstrained immigration enforcement. This Trump administration are going to be allowed to do an ethnic cleansing of this country and go after the people they see as enemies, which are Latinos.
Although the White House has said the National Guard would be sent to Chicago as an anti-crime move, Trump is now describing actions there as solely immigration enforcement. City officials point out that detaining migrant criminals has been standard practice for years, hardly requires a flood of troops, and would have negligible impact on street crime. Missouri labor unions are mobilizing against Republican redistricting plans and say they'll join community groups in a protest at the state capitol tomorrow. Republicans may try to crack the overwhelming Democratic Kansas City seat of Congressman Emmanuel Cleaver. Ariana Kimbrough is with the Missouri Workers' Center.
Only by joining together to confront the bullies from our state house to the White House who seek to control us will we stop illegal authoritarian power grabs and protect our freedoms and future.
Election officials and watchdogs are opposing cuts to the agency that assists local election authorities with cyber vulnerabilities. Defend the Vote says threats of foreign interference and violence on poll workers have put election officials on edge. Supporters of the cuts say too much federal involvement could bring red tape and shift control away from local officials. I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hey, how are you? Well, they're too good.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $45,000 by September 20th. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during our program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Jarrett Work from _ Native News about his recent article, Global Solidarity at the Mouth of the Klamath. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear with an overnight low of 62 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy, the daytime high of 77. Today in history, in 1947, the first ever case of a computer bug was found. A moth got lodged in the relay of a Harvard Mark II computer at Harvard University. The quote of the day is from Italian novelist Cesare Pavese, born this day in 1908. He said, quote, "We do not free ourselves from something by avoiding it, but only by living through it." A lawsuit in Alaska is attempting to reform the state's foster care system, ranked one of the worst in the country. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Alaska's Office of Children's Services is defending its practices in a court case that began in August. A national organization brought the class action lawsuit, hoping it can force court-mandated reforms to a system they say is failing kids and violating the Indian Child Welfare Act. About two-thirds of children in out-of-home care in the state are Alaska Native. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra has more.
When former foster youth Matthew Vandenberg took the stand on the first day of the federal trial, he told the judge about a foster placement he and other foster youth called the Ramen House. He recounted his testimony in an interview.
The people there would give you two ramen packs a day. And if you ate them, say, in the morning, you would have to wait until the next day to eat again. I lost over 30 pounds being at that foster home.
OCS is supposed to visit kids in their care monthly, but Marsha Lowry says those monthly visits in Alaska just aren't happening. She's an attorney and director of a national nonprofit, A Better Childhood, that brings lawsuits against states to push for foster care reforms.
How else can you know whether a child is safe when you put a child in a foster home?
Lowry says that on many federal measures, Alaska's foster care system ranks among the worst in the country.
Alaska is one of the few places that I know of that hires workers who don't have college degrees.
Lowry says lawsuits like this can be an effective way to force system reforms. She says when they sued New Jersey in 1999, their system was one of the worst in the country. Now it's one of the best. Alaska's foster care system has long been plagued with serious problems. In 2018, a law required reforms meant to reduce caseloads and staff turnover. The final audit released this year showed that by most measures, OCS hasn't made meaningful progress. The Office of Children's Services declined an interview for this story, but in her testimony, OCS Director Kim Guay consistently pointed out that her office is just one piece of Alaska's child welfare system. The federal trial is slated to wrap up September 10th. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
Recently, we brought you a story about a New Zealand man who was reunited with his Indigenous family in Canada after 50 years. He was part of Canada's 60 Scoop, and as Dan Karpinchuk reports, others who were taken away want help finding their biological relatives.
Jonathan Hooker of New Zealand recently returned to Manitoba and met his biological mother and other family members. He had been searching for them for years. He had been taken from them when he was only a few months old. Catherine Strongwind had a similar story. Only a year old when she was removed from her family in Winnipeg in 1973, she lived with a non-Indigenous family in Winnipeg. After years of searching, she eventually found her biological siblings and extended family. Strongwind and Hooker are among the estimated 20,000 Indigenous children who were taken from their families between the 1950s and 1980s. Many of those children were placed in non-Indigenous homes across Canada and around the globe. It was a plan of forced assimilation of Native children into white culture. University of Winnipeg history professor Karen Froman says most of the children didn't know about their Indigenous roots.
A lot of these adoptees are learning about their true heritage later in life, and a lot of them were lied to. You know, they were told they were either, you know, French or Italian, right, to explain why they were a little bit brown.
Froman says the 60s scoop was part government policy and part misunderstanding. She says rather than address social problems, it was easier for governments to remove the children. Advocates say as many as 3,000 Indigenous children were sent out of Canada and around the world. They say there must be more support so every one of those children can return home and meet with their families and communities. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Sea levels are rising more quickly in some places than others. Sea level report cards track uneven flood risk across the U.S. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As the climate warms and glaciers and ice sheets melt, sea levels are rising, and many coastal communities are flooding.
That flooding is going to get worse in the future. How fast it's going to get worse depends a lot on where you are.
Molly Mitchell of the Virginia Institute of Marine Science explains that seas rise at different rates along the coast because of variations in factors like ocean currents, temperature, and whether land locally is rising or sinking. In San Francisco, for example, the sea is rising about 2 millimeters per year. But in Rockport, Texas, it's rising about 3 times more quickly. To help communities know if their plans to address sea level rise will keep pace with the rate of change in their area, Mitchell's team created sea level report cards for more than 30 U.S. communities. The reports use data from tide gauges to track how much sea levels have already risen in each area and how fast they might rise in the next few decades.
I think the important thing to me is that people just keep in mind that the coastline is changing so that we develop our towns and our cities and we build our roads and everything with the idea that the coastline in 30 years will be different from what it is now.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Moves by the Trump administration indicate a substitution for an America First trading order, instead of the consensual order that has existed since the end of World War II. But as one observer notes, America First has turned out not only to be detrimental to Americans, it has largely been rejected around the world, with China's approach to globalization gaining favor. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertoff. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Tariff hikes across the board, political interference through trade threats, pressure on U.S. multinational corporations, supply chain disruptions. These are among the ways the Trump administration is trying to change the global economic order, from one based on consensus among the major players to one based on America First. Truth is, few countries find America First a model worth supporting. Trump administration officials consider the global trading order established at the end of World War II untenable and unsustainable, to quote Jameson Greer, the U.S. trade representative. He writes about, quote, American frustration, which really means the administration's frustration, at the system's failure to adapt to meet the essential needs of sovereign nations. The alternative? Not a new global system based on multilateral cooperation, since that would limit U.S. actions. Instead, the Trump people prefer, quote, a mix of tariffs and deals for foreign market access and investment. In other words, the approach taken with the European Union and Japan. And as between tariffs and deals, tariffs have priority because they can punish countries that have protected their markets and used various measures, such as subsidies and lax labor and environmental standards, quote unquote, to enhance their trade position. China comes first to mind. The administration is determined to stop the consequent flight of U.S. capital and production abroad. This America First argument is a recipe for trade protectionism, the weaponization of tariffs, and shakedowns of U.S. corporations. We can see the early results, not a win for American workers and consumers, nor even for many multinational corporations, but another opportunity for the concentration of political power in the Oval Office. Tariffs can be wielded to benefit those who are willing to play Trump's game, invest in the U.S., or suffer the consequences. In an unprecedented display of state capitalism, the administration has taken a slice of investment deals abroad, such as NVIDIA's AI chip sales in China, and a government share in U.S. corporations, as in the Nippon Steel-U.S. Steel deal and the 10% government share Trump demanded of Intel. In Trump's new trading order, U.S. policy doesn't distinguish between friend and adversary. Tariffs are being imposed based mainly on political rather than commercial considerations. With few exceptions, Russia so far is one, high tariffs have hit India, Canada, Japan, South Korea, and the European Union just as hard as they have hit China. In very few cases is a U.S. trade deficit the main reason for the high tariffs. India's purchases of Russian oil, Canada's constant criticism of Trump, South Korea's low level of military spending, Brazil's trial of right-wing former President Jair Bolsonaro, and China's challenge to the U.S. as global leader. These are among the actual reasons for Trump's tariffs. He's a spiteful and vengeful man. Careful reflection on the possible reactions of countries hit with the tariffs doesn't seem to have occurred in the Trump camp. Trump and his inner circle have always been oblivious to the power of nationalism abroad, even as they nurture American nationalism. The Canadians have turned to other markets and to buy Canadian. No Kentucky bourbon on their shelves. India is boycotting U.S. goods, and its leader is cozying up to Beijing and Moscow. The Chinese have embraced self-reliance in computer chips, to the point where car manufacturers are being told to stop using foreign chips. Brazil's leader has firmly rejected Trump's interference in its judicial system. South Korea, Japan, and the European Union have all pledged major new investments in the U.S., knowing full well that they can string along the actual investment process and might never have to make them at all if there's a change in administration. Writing in the magazine Foreign Affairs, Michael Froman warns, quote, "If Washington continues on its current course, defined by unilateralism, transactionalism, and mercantilism, the consequences will be grim, especially as Beijing continues on its own damaging course of subsidized excess capacity, predatory export policies, and economic coercion. The risk of the United States and China playing by their own rules, with power the only real constraint, is contagion. If the two largest economies in the world operate outside the rules-based system, other countries will increasingly do the same, leading to rising uncertainty, drags on productivity, and lower overall growth," unquote. Blame should, however, fall mainly on the U.S., for while Trump is rejecting globalization, the Chinese are embracing it. If the entry of their goods into U.S. markets is proving too expensive, they are moving exports and production elsewhere. The Chinese have become Global South leaders through their Belt and Road Initiative, which provides development loans, and through the export of goods, services, and production lines, particularly to Africa and Southeast Asia, but increasingly to Latin America. The more trade pressure Trump exerts, the better the Chinese look to many developing countries. I'm Mel Gertoff of the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Mel Gertoff, and Hannah Francis. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Simone Perez, Judith Ruiz Branch, Mike Moen, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3